Were we able to find if units moved around a great deal, or did they move around a lot in Yugoslavia?
Not from that. This only alerted you to where there was a barracks or something like that. And if one of these guys had said there was a barracks in the town of so and so, you just kept going until you found it. Mm-hmm. It was more very elementary. The war industry was perhaps the best of it all. Now, language. I'm terrible at languages. I spend an awful lot of time trying to learn French, and I can't really speak French at all. Mm-hmm. But I've had all kinds of tuition on it. I had many months I was at a nunnery over in Hull and all that kind of thing. But they weren't able to do anything with me either.
Except pray, I guess.
I guess that's about all. But so I'm terrible at languages. But Serbo-Croatian is, first of all, they write everything in Cyrillic as well as the Roman alphabet. Mm-hmm. And then it's a peculiar language in that everything has to agree with everything else, like Latin or Greek. And they always say inside the country that the only people who can speak it properly are university professors and lawyers. Nobody else can speak the language properly at all. Doctors never learn to speak the language, they say, and this kind of thing, you see, because it's so
complicated.
It's so terribly complicated to speak it well. Now, they once had, though, an old poet of theirs named Vuk, V-U-K, and it means wolf. But Vuk cleaned up the pronunciation and the spelling. Mm-hmm. And it's, as far as I know, the only language in the world that if you can pronounce a word, you can spell it.
It's all pronounced phonetically, in other words.
Yes, and if you can spell it, you can pronounce it. Mm. It's absolutely perfect. There are no double letters. Everything is worked out. I always used to tell the Yugoslavs, we cleaned up the grammar at the same time, we'd all be speaking Serbo-Croat, because it would be the most sensible language in the world. But he never did.
Mm-hmm. And was Serbo-Croatian the largest language group?
Yes, yes.
And did that tend to be the language of the government?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Was there a concerted effort to get the other nationalities to speak Serbo-Croatian?
Well, they had to. There wasn't any other way to do it. It's almost like India. If you wanted two Indian states wanted to talk together, they had to talk in English.
Mm-hmm. So the working operational language of the armed forces, for example,
Serbo-Croatian. All the way through. I don't know whether any of the minor republics had their own, probably had their own dialect, but not their own language.
No, I had the feeling that the Dalmatians were inclined to speak Italian.
Oh, well, they did. There were a lot of Italians left
like
over
that.
In Dalmatian.
But was it officially sanctioned by the government?
Oh, no, not at all.
So I would think that using a language like Serbo-Croatian would resurrect old differences of opinion. And might just provoke.
Well, they were pretty set on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There never seemed to be any question in their mind. Now, the language is so complicated that everybody speaks using the infinitive, the way you do in Southeast Pacific and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't say with a very complicated, take me a grammar and a dictionary to get the sentence out, I will go to Victoria tomorrow. You just use the infinitive. You say, I to go to Victoria tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I to go to Victoria yesterday. And that's the way they talk, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out to be a very simple language. It's like in French, if you want to get by in French, you use the word aller. I am going to. Instead of using the future or the past or anything else, you use Je vais aller, and sort of thing, and then you can say anything you want without having to worry about whether it agrees with anything else. So it's very simple once you start talking down to a peasant style.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there were very few people in the communist regime that didn't come from peasant backgrounds. So I could get on with them pretty darn well, but to read the formal language was beyond me. I could read words and things like that, but to,
and they made a point of sticking to the formal language in any publication.
Yes, yes.
I guess if they were trying to promote any sort of propaganda,
yes,
they would have to.
Yes, yes.
Well, who read the official publications of the newspapers? I mean, were they produced for the people, or were they produced for foreign consumption? Because if the people spoke and read this kind of language, could they understand formal Serbo-Croatian?
I think probably most of them could.
Mm-hmm.
when they saw it written, but to compose it yourself is a lot different than just getting it from Reed. The newspapers were all for domestic consumption.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any. They might have put in lead articles for the foreign press and that sort of thing, but they. I don't think they had a very large publication. I don't think that a lot of those villages ever saw a newspaper from one decade to the next.
Mm-hmm.
It was only the sort of the elite.
And like at the market, you didn't see them reading the newspaper.
Oh no, they didn't. They couldn't afford it. They couldn't afford to buy a newspaper.
And I should think the country has a very large or high illiteracy rate.
Oh yeah, very much so. Well, so much for language. I did get on.
Well, can I ask you this? If they're taking a peasant, say, from a Montenegrin a village, would they try and teach him how to read and write when he's in the army? Or was that...
Oh, yeah. Oh, the army, it was a 2-year conscription period. And about the first year, he really didn't learn very much in the way of military things. He was, first of all, your first year you did all the fatigues around the place.
Mm-hmm.
Their system was that an infantry battalion had 4 companies. The recruit went into a recruit training company when he was called up. Twice a year, I think, they had a call-up.
Was this and following he, the 2-year enlistment?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd stay in the number one company for 6 months. And about all he did was do fatigues and things like that, work in the cookhouse and so on. In the second 6 months, he learned to fire a rifle and get more qualified. And the last year, he'd be out on company tactics and maneuvers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd be released. And but all the way through, they had, I think, just as much time on what we would call educational programs as they did on military.
Mm-hmm.
They went into the history of the country. There was the certainly the education to bring them up in the writing level, writing and reading. And then they're all about the Communist Party and all about their programs and how the country was developing this and developing that. And they had a tremendous educational scheme for these people.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see them many times, driving along. You'd see the whole group, company out sitting on the grass, and the fellow up reading them a lecture on something. And that's what it was. It was a lot of it political education, but a great, great deal of it, basic patriotism and the history way back, centuries old history. They were teaching the patriotism from the word go.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they did a lot of it.
The Vietnamese did that too.
Hmm? The Vietnamese did an awful lot of that too. Yeah.
You brought up a point that strikes me immediately. You say that after the 2-year enlistment, they were brought call up every 6 months?
No, not after the 2 years. After the 2 years, they were on reserve.
With the same unit?
Well, they were told then what they were to do on mobilization.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their book, which told them right in the book what you were to do on mobilization. Go to a certain town, to the barracks there, and report for duty.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of thing. Now, they could be called up for exercises which were infrequent.
Mm-hmm.
There was no set schedule for drawing the reserves. Or they could simply wait until there was a real mobilization to be called up. But they were on reserve, and they could be called up at any time.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't turn out for a week's training every year or something like that, to the best of my knowledge.
Mm-hmm. No, it just struck me as being a bit odd, because you said that most people would be sent to another part of the country.
Yes.
To train with a unit.
Yes.
And then they'd go home, and then they'd be assigned, I suppose, to a militia unit, loosely using that term, near their hometown.
Oh, yes.
So the mobilization would take place there.
Yes. And you see, when they... everybody has to have their lichna karta. And if he moved to another town, got another job there, he'd have to go and report to the police, and they would look at his mobilization pictures and mobilization instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe give him new ones, you see. Now, in every town of any size, whatever, there was a fellow called a mobilization officer. And all he was usually a captain or a major, and very often a bit long in the tooth, this was his last posting or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And his role was to keep track of everybody in his bailiwick and where they were to report for duty, and all the animals, farm animals, wagons, trucks, cars, motorcycles, bicycles, everything.
Anything that could be used as...
Anything that he wanted to mobilize, or they said he should mobilize. It was all listed, and when the mobilization order came, they would go out to a farmer, produce three horses at so-and-so at such-and-such a time, or whatever it was, and so on. This was a standard system. It was pretty universal for Europe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they had this down to a T, and of course, if anybody moves around the country, he has to report him to the police, first of all, and then I guess he's referred to the mobilization officer, who then gives him new instructions.
Mm-hmm. Then would each village or each mobilization officer have jurisdiction over a cache of weapons? Or would they be supplied?
No, they were at the unit. He just had an office, very often about this size, because you'd see the sign out in the town, and you'd walk past, and here he was. He had one clerk and himself, and that's all there was in this office, and a bunch of books.
Mm-hmm.
No, he had nothing there himself.
Okay, but once the militia unit had been mobilized, there would be sufficient weapons near, close at hand, at least.
Oh, it had the reserves, the stocks nearby. We finally get around to my Canadian ambassador out there.
I was going to ask you about it. You had at least two, didn't you?
We only had one. We first had a chargé, but then James Scott MacDonald was there for all the rest of the time. And
he was a career diplomat, I take it.
He was. He had been a secretary to R.B. Bennett. R.B. Bennett's secretary when Bennett was the prime minister.
And I hope you're not going to tell me that he coined the phrase Bennett buggies.
I don't know about that. But he grew up with and was a contemporary of Pearson's.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said that Pearson had a soft spot in his heart for him because he was a contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he was first secretary in Paris in 1940. He was the high commissioner to Newfoundland after that, before Newfoundland joined Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And from there he went and became the ambassador in Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil.
And Brazil was an ally of ours, wasn't it?
Yes.
In sort of minimum sort of way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then from there he came to Yugoslavia as the ambassador there. And from there he went down to Vienna, didn't
mm-hmm.
he?
Mm-hmm.
Came the ambassador in Vienna.
That was a rather important posting at that time,
oh, yeah,
the height of the Cold
yeah.
War.
Mm-hmm.
He was terribly annoyed, and his wife was even more annoyed at being sent to Yugoslavia, though. Didn't think that was up to his standard. He was of the old school, and I don't say this in a derogatory manner. It was simply the caste that he'd been molded in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, their attitude was, and I think Pearson had a lot of it too, was that a diplomat, the job of the diplomat was to convey a message from his own country to the country to which he was accredited, or the vice versa, to go and get a message and take it back.
Mm-hmm.
There was no question of him being a snoop to observe on this foreign country at all. You were there officially, if you wanted to know anything about the country, you went and you asked them, and you took their answer and you sent it back home. Now, that was so ingrained in him that any mention of the word intelligence would sort of scare him silly.
Mm-hmm.
And as an example of that, now that's not the young, modern diplomat's conception of it at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, how old a man was this chap?
God, we always used to call him Old Mac, but he looked like he was about 70. But
he was considerably older than we, but he was still alive a few years ago.
He must be terrible.
Well, if he was a contemporary of Pearson's, he must have been born about 1895 or 1895,
mm-hmm.
something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which would have made him First War material.
Because
Pearson was, I believe.
Yeah, Pearson was. I don't remember what he did in World War.
Never heard what he did.
Never heard of that.
Well, maybe he was in university then or something.
Mm-hmm.
Never heard what he did.
He might have been, I don't know.
So I should place him about 55 to 60?
Well, he certainly wasn't any younger.
Yeah.
But that was his... And he believed it, you know, and that was the way he'd been brought up, and he thought that anybody who tried to do anything underhand or intelligence-wise didn't know what the score was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, none of his staff really had that same concept at all.
Well, they were presumably much younger than
they were all very much younger than I was, practically all of them. And as a result, there was very little cohesion between his staff and himself on almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was about his only confidant he had in the place, because he told me so many things that I don't think he would have told any of them at all. However...
Was it perhaps the fact that the people would work not against him, but they wouldn't fill him in with a complete picture if they didn't trust him, say?
I can give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
The fellow who was the third secretary there was a staunch Roman Catholic. And Canada, the Roman Catholics in Canada, and I didn't know the hierarchy here, but they were putting pressure on External Affairs,
mm-hmm,
to bring pressure on Yugoslavia to take the pressure off the Roman Catholics out there, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So, as a beginning, External Affairs sent a request out to the embassy saying, we'd like a study of how the Yugoslavs are treating religion, and in particular the Roman Catholic Church, in Yugoslavia, you see?
Was this after the Pope's Vatican ambassador had been sent home?
No, I don't think it was. I think it was before that. Now, there must have been a lot of background before that, but I was not aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
However, we did get this request, at least the ambassador got it. He turned it over to the third secretary. And he showed me his report, which was anything but what the Yugoslavs would have said about themselves if you'd asked them, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all the details of how the church schools were being deprived of any kind of paper so that they couldn't publish anything for any schools they were running, your religious schools or anything, you see, and things like that. There was the screws were being put on them from every direction,
mm-hmm,
by the regime. And it was all laid out in a pretty careful and well-analyzed study. I'm sure he got a lot of very useful information for it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he showed it to old Mac. I always called him old Mac. And old Mac said, oh, no, not at all. He said, I'll handle this matter. He went down, made an appointment with the Yugoslav Minister of the Interior, and said, now I'd like to get your report on how you handle religion in this country. So anybody could have written it. I could have written what he was going to say,
mm-hmm,
of how tolerant they were and all this kind of thing, and that their state was respecting all their rights and all this kind of rubbish, you see, and so on. And so Mac came back with this in the report, and he sent that back to Ottawa. Well, you see, now that's why his junior was totally disaffected when it came down to it. He said, this is ridiculous, doing that kind of diplomacy. It isn't that kind of an age to do that in. We're just contributing to ignorance when we do that kind of thing. But old Mac thought he was right.
Mm-hmm.
That
was
his
junior
approach.
Man sent his report in?
No, he couldn't send it in. He could only send it in through the embassy.
Well, could he not go through you and say, would you send this to your...
Oh, well, you don't do that in External Affairs. Not
if
you've
got
a future of your own. No, so he couldn't send it, you see. It never did get sent.
So there were no examples of, say, younger people who wanted to go around the old Mac?
No.
They couldn't do that?
Well, yeah, there were, but not in that sense of reporting on Yugoslavia. They made some very derogatory remarks about him, but it wasn't on his conduct as an ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
And
who were the comments we made to other officials at External Affairs?
Yeah. Old Mac came and told me all about it, because he said, I got more friends back there than they had.
Yeah, well, Pearson was in charge of those days, didn't he? Yeah.
Well, however, that was... But I
You're going to talk about your confidence, or that you were his confidant.
Well, that's the way that he sort of, he used to tell me a lot of things like that. I don't think he ever told anybody else those sort of things at all.
Well, why did he choose you, do you think?
Well, I was more his age than anybody else, and I don't know. We just got on with him pretty well.
Because it seems to me that if you were, you know, there with the intelligence community, your primary role, and he was against that sort of...
Well, now, that we didn't click on that, you see, because, like, for example, he wouldn't admit that I was doing anything on intelligence. And I came to him one time, and I said, now, look, they've moved a couple of divisions here, and it looks as though they may have something in mind, you see, and so on and so on. So he said, well, where did you get this? And I said, well, it's from our observation. Oh, no, I won't report that. I wanted him to send it back through external affairs channels. Well, he said, no, he didn't care what I sent back through my own channels.
Mm-hmm.
But he wouldn't admit that he'd seen it even, you see. He didn't want to admit that I was doing, be associated with anything that didn't come from the Yugoslav government officially, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, it just couldn't enter his mind that you should do that. It was the wrong thing to do.
Well, let me ask you this. Did he have a personal opinion about the Yugoslav government which he shared with you? And
no.
He wouldn't have that, at least he wouldn't enunciate what it would be.
No, he wouldn't get into that at all. No, we never discussed that kind of thing.
So he was really an old school fellow.
Oh, yeah, he was. Oh, yes. But there are a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I really use him as an example because there are so many of them in external affairs who have that same thing. And all the way through, there is that difference of opinion of the younger group who... I'll try and bring this out later, but they're embarrassed that the external affairs are so old-fashioned.
Almost naive in their approach to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And these younger diplomats, a lot of them become disillusioned very quickly when they find this is the way the department's being run.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would too. I mean, you're there to represent the country, and you're there in their own best interest.
Well,
and you can't do it if you're providing information which is pure propaganda.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Now, old Mac never asked me to change my plans in any way except one time. And I can't remember why it was he wanted me to change it. It was somebody's national day or something like that. And it was going to be a conference in Trieste. Well, I couldn't miss that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I had said to him, well, I'm sorry, but I really feel that my department, you see, this is a big argument, my department would want me to attend up there. So he was a very cautious fellow. He didn't say anything, but about two or three days later he said to me, he said, I can't think that conference of yours up there is all that important. Because he said, I asked the French ambassador if he was sending his attaché, and he said no. So of course I had him right there. I said, Mr. McDonald, you didn't admit that we're having an intelligence conference up there because the French are supposed not to know about it, you see. So, well, the poor old guy just clam up on something like that right away because he realized he made a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm.
However, I marched off to the conference. But that's the only time he ever tried to interfere with my work, and it wasn't very successful.
Well, did you have to clear everything with him if you wanted to, say, go on a trip? You'd have to tell him what
well, about. That's the way you were supposed to do it. But he said after I was there a short while, you see, he didn't want the responsibility of approving me to go on these trips, so he got away from that by saying, never mind telling me when you go, just tell me when you come back.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, suited me perfectly. I had a free hand from then on.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're the only person at the embassy who had a complete free hand because you weren't external affairs.
Oh, yeah, he wouldn't let the other people do anything. They couldn't go out and do anything, you know. He was a rascal when it came to security, because he used to stick documents under his blotter and things like that. Really awful. But, in fact, the girls had to come and get me to tick them off on things like that, because none of them dared say anything to him.
Well, how safe was the embassy itself?
Well, the security there was was very
primitive.
We had no security. All our documents, every morning, we had to go over to the British Embassy and get them out of their safe.
You didn't have your own safe?
No. Take them there, use them for the day, take them back at night. Every day.
The whole time you were there?
All the time we're there. And shortly after I left, they turned my office into a living quarters for the security guard, and they sent out a Canadian security guard to live on the premises,
mm-hmm.
which would have solved the problem, but not while I was there. Every day we had to take all the things over. And this limited our filing system tremendously. I had to use onion skins and all that kind of thing to keep the volume of it down.
Well, what about your card index files? Would they be in the British?
Yeah. I had two great big huge suitcases like that. And then my sergeant would have to go and get them every morning and take them back at night. All the embassy papers had to be anything that was secure.
Well, I should think that if the Yugoslavs are watching you and you took out a particular suitcase, they knew what was in it, they could tell precisely what you were working on that given day.
Well, there was a security guard, a policeman on the front of the embassy all the time, one of theirs.
Yugoslav, yeah.
All embassies had it.
Just to see you in Ottawa, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, old Mac, we got to know them pretty well, he and his wife. They lived only a block or so away from us, and he used to have dinner parties for 12, I think it was, because he had a gold dinner set, 12 people, supplied by Canada. And if ever there was anybody missing and couldn't go at the last minute, he'd phone us up and say, get over here fast, fill in. So we got a lot of dinner parties at his place.
It would change the seating arrangement, too, if one was short, you see. We couldn't have it at all
if anybody was missing, so we'd get called in a lot of times.
Well, what sort of people would he invite? Would it be
all ambassadors and things, sort of thing. So we got to meet a lot of high-level people there. Mind you, we didn't say very much in a group like that. You don't do too much talking. They do all the talking.
Mm-hmm. Would you have to be decked out in uniform?
No, not for that. Well, usually it would be black tie, and she'd have a long dress. But no, we did not uniform for that.
Would you ever wear a uniform in Yugoslavia?
Oh, yeah.
On official events, mm-hmm. I should think.
All national days we did.
Mm-hmm.
And to the May Day parade, or when they took us out on tours, anything like that, we'd wear a uniform.
Easier to keep tabs on you, I should think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Old Mac had, he'd done his thesis on the U.S. Constitution. And it was really embarrassing because after the dinner party was over, you know, the men go off for their cognac and cigars and the ladies go off to powder their noses. And old Mac would always bring this thing up about the U.S. Constitution. There'd always be some Americans around, you know, the first secretary, consul or somebody like that. Or the ambassador. Oh, gee, it was always painful because he knew more about their Constitution than they did themselves. And it was, of course, I heard it so many times, it was all old hat for me, but
that's why you learned a lot, too.
Yeah, but he drew the analogy between the U.S. Constitution. He'd ask them a few questions, of course. He'd catch them out right off the bat with a few tricky questions. Then he'd start to lecture them on it. And he said, well, of course, he said, you're great fathers of the U.S. He said, they're really very simple people. He said, all they did was they just took the British system and adapted it. They said, well, the king used to appoint the governor of the province, okay. They couldn't let the king continue to do that, so they said everybody in the state will elect the governor. And the same thing for the president. Everybody in the country elects the president, and he's, and so on. And then all the representatives, they come from the, their constituencies and so on, and they vote on them, you see, and so on. And that's the same as it was in the colonial days. Then they say the governor was the only man that the king allowed to spend any money. So that's your executive branch of the government. The Congress can't spend a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
They can just authorize the president to spend the money. And that's the way your constitution worked under the British. He says, all you did was adapt the whole British system to your country. And you think you got a new country. You see, you just stick the knife in and twist it around. And they didn't really know enough to argue with them. And most of them found this quite astounding because they'd never thought of it that way before.
Yeah. Well, how do the Americans view old Mac?
Oh, I think everybody thought he was a little bit of an old stick. he was sharp, boy. He helped me a lot when I was the doyen of the attaché corps because he knew so much about diplomatic affairs and so on. He gave me good advice.
Did you find, though, that he was the only stick in the mud of the Western diplomats there?
Oh, no. Oh, the French are...
French are sticking other things, but not in the mud.
Well, I don't suppose I got to know them that well.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm alluding to is, did they have the same opinion of their role within, from what you were able to discern?
Certainly not the British or Americans. Mm-hmm. They didn't have that idea at all. But the others, I wouldn't say too much.
Yeah,
I certainly don't think the Turks or the Greeks had any illusions about what their attachés were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't know about the rest of them at all. Old Mac always stood up for me, sort of thing. One time we got a $2,000 food order from Denmark, and there was one bottle of a liqueur in the whole damned order for about $5 or something. And the damn silly people in Denmark put on the order $2,000 worth of liquor. So they had me up, and Mac had to go and bail me out. And I took my invoice with me and so on, so it was all very well. But Mac was very good about the thing. He could have been a little shirty, I thought, but he was very good about seeing me through all this. And then we ran into a very unfortunate thing that I had to claim diplomatic immunity. We had a Yugoslav instructors for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And each morning the driver would go down to the town and pick her up and bring her up to my house to do the instruction. Well, he went down, he had our nanny with him, and the youngest girl, who was, what, about four then?
Yeah, she didn't have instructions, just the older one.
No, just the older one. To pick up nanny, and came back. On the way back, he had an accident, a vehicle accident, and this instructress, whose name was Bronca, was wounded, sort of thing, and her leg was bleeding and that kind of thing. Our own nanny and the child weren't hurt at all. It was a very minor thing.
They were just shaken.
They were just shaken up. And, however, this girl, this girl's uncle was an old-time, a capitalist kind of thing, and he'd been a lawyer. So he talked her into suing me for damages.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, we had to have, I had to be prosecuted in court. So I was issued a summons, you see, and so on.
Could that happen?
Well, then I took it to Mac and said, look, I expect you're going to get me diplomatic immunity. So it isn't all that easy he explained it all to me, because he thought it was going to be a darn difficult job to convince Ottawa that I shouldn't stand trial first and prove that I'm innocent, you see. I wasn't even in the vehicle, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But that was their law, that the owner of the vehicle is responsible if it gets in an accident. Doesn't matter who's driving.